Every month, we offer exciting new webinars for our community. Topics include how to use retirement accounts to buy real estate overseas, how to get a second passport in Latin America, why you should sell your stock portfolio and move your money offshore, how to buy beachfront rental properties in Brazil for less than $100,000, or apartments in Paraguay for less than $60,000. If you want to join us for free for these presentations with live Q&A, insider secrets, and exclusive opportunities with my professional network of experts, then go to expatmoney.com/webinars. That's expatmoney.com/webinars to register for free upcoming presentations. expatmoney.com/webinars.
We all dream of seeing the world, but the realities of living somewhere outside your place of birth can be daunting, to say the least. Welcome to the Expat Money Show, helping you make the most out of your overseas career through conversations with successful expats on investing, entrepreneurship, self-improvement, and continual education, all while sharpening your financial acumen. Now please welcome your host, with over 20 years of overseas experience, Mikkel Thorup.
Hey everyone, I am so excited about today's episode and I can't wait to get into it and share it with you. But I just wanted to remind you before we get going today to visit expatmoneyshow.com and sign up for my private newsletter, EMS Pulse. Right now we are sharing the weekly episodes from the podcast, but also a ton of other products and services that we're going to be offering, lots of language programs, lots of tips and tricks for being an expat, whether you're a first-time expat or an expat hopeful. There's just so much going on at expatmoneyshow.com. I really hope that you get a chance to come and visit us, join the newsletter, and then from there, maybe join our Facebook group at expatmoneyforum.com. Lots happening. I really want to share it with you guys, and the best way to stay connected is through these two sites, expatmoneyshow.com and expatmoneyforum.com. Thanks so much. Enjoy today's episode. Cheers.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Mikkel Thorup. This is the Expat Money Show, and today's guest has been described by the Wall Street Journal as the real Indiana Jones. His lifelong accomplishments are so impressive that it's hard to pick just a few. At age 12, he was the youngest Eagle Scout in American history and traveled to the White House to meet President Eisenhower. At 14, he was the youngest person to summit Matterhorn in the Swiss Alps. And in 1979, he had led an expedition retracing, for the first time in history, Hannibal's route over the Alps with elephants. In 1981, he set the world record for the most northerly parachute jump at 90 degrees north, free-falling right into the North Pole. And in 1996, he defeated both Vladimir Putin and his KGB bodyguard in an arm wrestling match in Kelly's Irish Times bar on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. Many would say that he is one of the greatest explorers and most interesting man of modern times. Please welcome to the show Dr. Jack Wheeler. Jack, how are you doing?
I'm okay, except I'm not so sure after that introduction.
I did a lot of research to do that introduction, Jack. I like that introduction.
Okay, well, here we go.
Jack, why don't you take a couple of minutes? And I know I've already given a bit of backstory, but how did you become an explorer? How did you get into geopolitics and traveling so extensively?
Oh, good heavens. Well, I'm always, you know, I'm always a little embarrassed about that Indiana Jones stuff because, I mean, he's a fictional character. I mean, he never loses his hat, you know, and so I'm actual real. And so, some of the stuff may be compared to that, but I'm a, you know, real person with all the flaws and stuff like that that comes with everybody else. But at any rate, I grew up in, a suburb of Los Angeles, Glendale, California, a very prosaic place, never knew much about the world. I read a book when I was 14. It was by a famous adventurer back in the 1920s and 30s. It was an old book, but a friend of my father's gave it to me. He thought it might be fun. And the man was Richard Halliburton. He just talked about all these places in the world, and the way he described them just made, it was a revelation. I've never forgotten it to this day, how eye-opening it was that the world we have is a place of endless magic and adventure, and you'd never, ever get to the bottom of it. That has stuck with me all these years. People collect things. They collect stamps, coins. They have collections. And I kind of made up my mind back then that I wanted a collection of extraordinary experiences, of real adventures, really extraordinary memories and experiences to fill my life up with, because that you can't take away. You can lose your stamp collection, but you can never lose what you've done with your life. And so that's been my whole life. When I was 14, my father worked with was a producer at a television show and television station, a local television station in Los Angeles. And he figured out a way to get us visas to the Soviet Union, to Russia, and to, Europe is easy, but actually in 1958, quite frankly, it was very exotic for a family to go to Europe back then. Sounds amazing, but that's the way it was. Jet travel had just begun. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure we did. We went on a Lockheed Constellation or something, propeller. It took all, two days to get to Europe. At any rate, he convinced the television station to have a television show, a series, that he would film an American family in Europe, particularly the Soviet Union. That was a big deal. That was a big deal to go to the Soviet Union back at the very height of the Cold War. And so I got to meet kids at school, and they were very nice to me. But I had two experiences that were pretty revelatory. The first was the kids in the school were so nice, and they'd been taught to hate Americans and we're the great enemy of the world, etc. But they were really nice to me. And so I got out my pen, my little Papermate ballpoint pen, and I had a little notepad. I was getting their names from the interpreter we had. Her name is Vadia. And I noticed as I was writing their names down to get their name, they were all looking at my pen. And so I asked Vadia, I said, Vadia, why are they looking at my pen? And she took it, and she looked at it, she studied it, and she said, we don't have such things in Soviet Union. And it took me a little while to process that. Wait a minute. This is a country that is threatening the United States with nuclear annihilation, and they don't know how to make a 25-cent ballpoint pen. Something is wrong. Something doesn't make sense. And then we went to Red Square and we went to Lenin's tomb. And then back in those days, in 1958, Stalin was still in Lenin's tomb. Khrushchev took him out in 61. But I'll never, ever forget it, because there was this long line. We're the foreign guests, so we get to go in front of the line. And it was entering a sacred religious shrine. And everybody was so quiet. And nobody said a word. And it was just the shuffling of feet. And there was Stalin on the left in the glass box. And there was Lenin on the right. And you passed by and didn't say a word. Like they were these holy, sainted figures. And I came out really shook. I was shaking, because I'm 14, but I knew that these two men were among the greatest mass murderers, the most evil people that have ever existed on the face of this earth. And here they would be treated as moral heroes, moral demigods. And why people would worship evil, I haven't really got an answer to that to this day. I just knew it happened. And I remembered the ballpoint pen. And I said, to myself, any country that can't make a ballpoint pen can be had. We can beat these people. We don't have to put up with this. And and then I, you know, of course I'm 14 and I'm a teenager. You know, I kind of forgot about that. I had this fantasy about, you know, organize. Then came the Hungarian Revolution. And I realized, I thought about the Hungarian Revolution, and I realized that the reason that the Soviets were able to crush it is that only Hungary rebelled. Only Hungary. And so the Soviets were able to squash it, and Eisenhower wasn't able to do anything about it. And I thought, you know, if only all of the colonies could rise up, and so they couldn't push them down, they couldn't squash them all, then you'd have a chance. Then they'd have a chance. And I had a fantasy about that, which I probably forgot. It's like, you know, I mean, I'm a teenager, right? 15, 16, I guess the girls were more interesting. Kind of majored in too much beer and, you know, too many dating girls in high school and college. It's in college, actually. But at any rate, then I read Ayn Rand. That was revelatory to me as well. I'll never forget, you lead a financial show. Probably one of the greatest intellectual experiences in my life, certainly my young life, was reading Francisco D'Anconia's speech on money in Atlas Shrugged. And because finally somebody had provided a moral defense of capitalism. Obviously, it's the most practical system. It's the only system that actually works and creates prosperity. The left is always attacking it morally. Oh, it's exploitation and all this other stuff. And she gave a moral defense that I've always wanted to hear. So that got me interested in philosophy. And I ended up getting a PhD in philosophy, primarily Aristotle. Rand turned me on to Aristotle, and I realized this is my home. Aristotle, to me, still to this day, is the greatest thinker that ever lived. He has a moral way of looking at things that is very similar to Randian philosophy, by the way. So I got a PhD in philosophy, but I didn't want to teach philosophy. I decided I wanted to have an adventurous life. And so, I'd had one already when I was 16. I was a beginning student in anthropology back then. I talked my way into getting adopted by a tribe of Hebrew headhunters in the Amazon, the tribe that makes shrunken heads. They actually adopted me. I was all by myself, 16. And it's just been one adventure after another. So I formed an adventure company, Wheeler Expeditions, and I started taking people to the North Pole. I wrote a book called The Adventurer's Guide because back then there were no adventure travel companies. If you wanted to climb the mountain or live with the headhunters or explore Outer Mongolia, how do you do that? Now there's plenty of companies, but we're the oldest. At any rate, I wrote a book because people write books about their adventures. They went up the river and met the tribe and climbed a mountain or whatever, and then that's that. But they never tell you how you could do that yourself. So my book, The Adventurer's Guide, was how to swim the Hellespont, live the Headers, and hunt and mat the tiger, and explore our Mongolia, etc. And then you could how to do that yourself. How you could do those things. So that was a unique book that got me started. Got me on Johnny Carson and Mark Griffin and all these shows, and that got my business started. And I started taking people to the North Pole and leading elephants over the Alps and finding lost tribes in New Guinea and other places. I have three first contacts now. one with the one with the Alcas, the Alca Ashiri in the Amazon, and one a tribe, a cannibal tribe called the Wali Ali Fo in New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, and one with a band of Bushmen in the Kalahari. A very, very extraordinary experience every time.
So, Jack, when I'm doing my research on you, and I read, like, I've got a, it's like a timeline of these incredible events that you've done, and all these things that you've accomplished during your life. And then I came across this quote, because I did see that you had done your PhD in philosophy, in Aristotelian ethics. And I want to read it, and I think that this kind of puts things in perspective, and I would like to hear your opinion about it. So, a life of eudaimonia is a life of striving. It's a life of pushing yourself to your limits and finding success. A eudaimonic life will be full of happiness that comes from achieving something really difficult rather than just having it handed to you. I think that's so brilliant because when I look at all of these things that you've accomplished, Jack, is that something that you live by, achieving something really difficult? Like, what does that mean to you?
Well, I don't know about difficult, but that's a very Aristotelian statement. The term is eudaimonia. And eudaimonia is an Aristotelian term of Aristotle's. You read all about it in the Nicomachean Ethics. But it's normally translated as happiness. And that is a mistranslation. Because happiness, when we use that word, it's used to what is it as a category, as an Aristotelian category. And it, we use it as a state. It's a state of being. And for Aristotle, happiness is not a state of being. It is an activity. The word that he used was energeia. Eudaimonia is an energeia. It is activity. It is the doing of life. And it is not something you go out to achieve. I'm going to climb that mountain and I'm going to be, and what else are you going to do? Well, I'm also going to be happy. No. Doesn't work that way. You only can get to happiness indirectly by doing other things. By doing things in the doing and doing this and the achievement, you are happy thereby. So I think that is what the author of that quote is getting at. The difficulty, I'm not sure about that. I've never looked at the things that I've done are difficult. There are things that I wanted to do. You know, I mean, skydiving in the North Pole, was that difficult? Well, no. It was just something that I aimed for. I learned how to do it. I got good at it. And I had the greatest time doing it. And actually jumping out of an airplane by myself, 8,000 feet over the Arctic Ocean, exactly at 90 north, the North Pole, that's an experience that will stay with me forever. I just can't imagine how to describe the power of that experience. But was it a difficult thing? No. So I'm not sure about the difficulty.
But this is interesting because I think back to my own life, Jack, and I think about what happiness is. Like for me, if I could have been happy in my hometown, you know, with a white picket fence and living a quote unquote normal life, I think about how easy that would have been. But for myself, like I started traveling as a teenager and went exploring. And for me to find happiness, I had to be on the road. I had to travel. I had to do these things that a lot of people would say is very difficult. Now, I don't know which side I kind of fall on. If I think with you, think the same as you is it difficult? But certainly the paths that we have chosen are quite different than anyone else that you're going to find on the planet.
Well, there you go. That's the difference. We're all unique individuals. Every single human being that is on the planet right now, that has ever lived or ever will live, is completely unique. You have completely unique DNA. And you have a completely set, different set of experiences that and choices that determine your life. But to get back to the Aristotelian context, Aristotle would say that he takes things individually. He talks for the famous thing about the golden mean. Okay? Well, the golden mean of a balance between too much and too little. Too much courage would be recklessness. Too little courage would be timidity, for example. Okay? Well, he said everybody is different. Milo the wrestler needs a certain amount of food to maintain his energy. But that's not the same for everybody else and not the same for the average person. So there are people that the white picket fence and a normal, what we would call a normal, regular, middle-class life and married, family, kids, etc., well, that's wonderful. That's a wonderful thing. And that's appropriate for many people. In a genetic context, to tell you the truth, quite frankly, I've always thought we have the two categories of people. There's many, many categories, but among them are two. One are explorer genes and stay-at-home genes. We need both. We need both kind of people. And for a stable society, the people who want to go out there and see what's over the horizon and figure things out. That's why we started out in Africa and spread all over the earth, everywhere in the world. But then people got to keep the home fires burning. And so it depends upon the individual and what is right for them. And that's an individual choice. They've got to figure that out. Now, as far as the difficulty in that quote you mentioned, well, it's good to kind of challenge yourself. It's good to stretch yourself. It's good to push the envelope, but not, but be careful. I mean, don't do things that are too wild, too reckless for you. You've really got to know yourself and really got to know what you're capable of and what really is your right balance for you in your life. And that's different for everybody.
So how do you find out things like that? How would you ever know what is the balance for yourself?
Doing. Activity. Energeia. You don't sit there and, you know, meditate on your navel, you know. You're always thinking of, well, for me, what would be really cool to do? What would be really, really cool to do? What would I really, really, what would be really neat? And with my business, I think, what would other people that I know and that with my kind of people would really think is cool too? Like, for example, the hottest thing we do right now is our Himalaya helicopter expedition. People think of going to Mount Everest. You know, you trek to Mount Everest for two weeks at altitude. It's a difficult trek. Okay. And, but the frustrating thing is you never see the mountain because Everest is always hidden by big mountains in the way. There's one little place where you can kind of see it. It's a viewpoint called Kalapatar, and you can see it from there. But what about all the other great mountains of the Himalayas? Kanchenjunga, Dalagiri, Annapurna, Makalu, Manaslu, etc. Why, those mountains, well, nobody ever treks to all of the great mountains of the Himalayas. So I figured a way to do it by helicopter. And when you do it by helicopter, you see the mountains in a way you can't see on the ground. It's like unbelievable. The only, not even climbers see the mountain the way we do. And we go to all eight of the highest mountains in the Himalayas by helicopter. And it is just the most mind-blowing experience. I mean, we do it in the spring and the fall, late April, early May, and late October, early November. And, I can hardly wait every time. It is the most mind-blowing experience, and it changes people's lives. And being able to give people experiences like that, I don't just take people on expeditions and adventures. I take them on experiences they will never forget for the rest of their lives. That's the kind of experience that I want. That's the kind of experience I want to give people. Experience they tell their grandchildren about, and their grandchildren would say, you know, my granddad or my grandmom, you wouldn't believe what they did. They tell that to their kids. Those are the kinds of experiences that I want, and ring my bell. And that's what I've been doing all my life.
Well, it's interesting because I own a very small travel agency, and I was talking to my staff when I was doing the research for your interview, and they're like, but we run tours as well. I'm like, yeah, but we run like bus tours and we run, you know, safaris, but they're staying in like 5-star hotels. And it's like, what we do is cool. Like, we have some awesome stuff, but I'm like, this is quite different. Very, very different, I would say.
Well, you know, I'm a fan of 5-star hotels. I mean, we get out there in the bush or the Gobi Desert or the Tibetan Plateau. Okay, great, fan. But when we get back to civilization, I want to stay in the best hotel there is. I mean, I think the person who invented hot showers is one of the great benefactors of mankind. I mean, I think civilization is great. I don't want to live in a cave, you know. And I don't want anybody to do to my country what the socialists have done to Venezuela. I mean, civilization and capitalism and prosperity is wonderful. So that's great. But at any rate, yeah, that's what we do. We do things that really get out there and really explore the world.
Well, I agree with you 100%. And it's just interesting to kind of hear the background and the motivation and where things like this started from. Because even when I look back at my own life, it's hard to put things in sequential order and how they came about. When did I start pushing the boundaries? Like, what did I do in my life that led me to travel so extensively? And for me to hear other people's lives and what was the catalyst in theirs, and what they spent their time doing, like you, for example, getting your PhD in ethics, is very, very interesting, because it's not the first thing that would come to mind when I think of, and I won't use the quote that embarrassed you earlier, but someone who is an explorer.
So I want to remind you to go to expatmoneyshow.com to pick up your free special report called 19 International Strategies to Grow and Protect Your Wealth Abroad. We have had some really good feedback with this. It's actually a project I've been working on for probably about 4 years now and been offering it to my subscribers. And I am constantly updating it with the best and the newest resources for people wanting to go abroad. It is really amazing. I'm really happy with the work that we've done. And it's really different than a lot of the other projects out there or special reports or ebooks or anything like that. And this is one of the main differences. It is highly curated, it is highly condensed. It is not 400, 500 pages long and talking about every single thing out there and every single little detail. Actually, that doesn't serve anyone. Your best bet is always to go with the really, really condensed information so that you can connect the dots, so you can understand what's happening and how things fit together. And that's exactly what this special report does. So it's called 19 International Strategies to Grow and Protect Your Wealth Abroad. You can find it completely for free, 100% free at expatmoneyshow.com. Okay, enjoy, and let's jump back into the interview.
Well, you know, for me, it's kind of all the same. You know, knowing more about the world and understanding about the world, I didn't get into philosophy to teach like most people do. They get a PhD in philosophy and that's what they teach. I wanted to be able to think clearly, you know. I mean, I'll give you a very small prosaic example, but I'm sure you get this stuff too, but because we all do, somebody sends you some email that they've heard that some amazing, oh, you won't believe this thing. And they send it out to everybody in their email list. And I just have a very good detector of stuff like that. I say something smells. You know, I mean, every so often, okay, there's something to it, but most of the time it's a hoax, some email hoax. And I have to write my friend and say, don't do this. You know, don't send out stuff that, check it out first. Make sure, rather than, oh, well, look at this. Everybody would like to know about this. So I've had to come down, and some of my friends said, please, don't do this. You know, this is about the third time you've done it. Don't do it anymore. Philosophy teaches you, if you do it right, it teaches you how to think clearly. And also, there's another thing. The more that I studied, I mean, I went through Oriental philosophy. I went through every great philosopher in the history of Western civilization, etc. And I came to the conclusion there is absolutely nothing so absurd and so ridiculous and so unbelievable that some philosopher somewhere, sometime hasn't seriously advocated it as true. It's just amazing. So that the whole study of philosophy, the main benefit was to enable me to think. I like to think pretty clear about things, and to use reason and logic, and to understand the world. And understanding the world with reason and logic is a very handy thing to have when you're exploring it.
I think about my own quest, I suppose, to understand the world. And it is interesting when you read philosophy, and obviously everybody who is writing philosophy believes that their way is correct and just and moral. But it is true that a lot of it is ridiculous. Like, and we can talk about socialism or communism, which I know you've had a lot of dealings with in your life. You know, those types of philosophies, like they're clearly broken. They clearly do not work. So how did you start on Aristotle? Like what initially drew you to that type of ethics and philosophy and understanding?
Well, first, reading Atlas Shrugged and reading Ayn Rand, and she made many references to Aristotle. And she also made references a lot to an economist named Ludwig von Mises. I don't know if you're maybe familiar with von Mises.
Oh, absolutely. I've read several of his books. It's mind-blowing stuff.
When I was a graduate student, I started up a correspondence with von Mises. And this was in the late 60s. And he invited me to come and see him. So I was a graduate student at the University of Hawaii at the time. And I saved up all my money and bought a cheap ticket to L.A. and a Greyhound bus ticket that allowed you to ride all over the United States for a month for $99. And I rode a bus clean across the United States and spent a weekend with Ludwig von Mises at his home in a place called Franconia Notch. Had a cabin up there in New Hampshire. He signed my copy of Human Action. And it was a very profound experience. For me, very, very profound. And von Mises was an Aristotelian, too. But when I started reading Aristotle, the politics, the rhetoric, the metaphysics, and particularly the Nicomachean Ethics, because I'm studying all the Greeks have always called me, because they're the founders of Western civilization. So I wrote my doctoral thesis on a Greek ethics, but primarily leading up to Aristotelian ethics. And that was just did it for me. I mean, that's it. It's never gotten better ever since, as far as I'm concerned. the Declaration of Independence is a very Aristotelian document, for example. At any rate, the Aristotelian outlook on life has helped me a great deal.
That must have been quite of an experience to meet Mises. How old were you then?
How old?
Mm.
It was, I have to go over and get it. There's a letter there he wrote to me, and it was 1969. So I was 25. Yes, about 25.
Wow. What an influential person to meet at that age. My goodness, that would just... I read his work now, and I'm just so surprised that things like this are not taught in schools, or at least in the schools that I saw.
Right, right. So, yeah, it's the greatest economic mind that ever was. So I would encourage all your listeners, if they aren't familiar with Ludwig von Mises, M-I-S-E-S, Ludwig von Mises, his magnum opus is Human Action, but there's a great little book called Bureaucracy. There is a last paragraph in Bureaucracy. It's a small book. He talks about how liberals will end up calling themselves progressives. And this was written in 1948. So he's well worth reading. I'd also suggest they read The Anti-Capitalistic Mentality. The Anti-Capitalist Mentality.
I haven't read that one myself.
Yeah, that's a short book. It's short, just like Bureaucracy. They're very well worth reading, but if you really want to get into it, just holy Toledo, read Human Action.
That's awesome as well that at 25 years old, you send someone like that a letter and strike up a correspondence and go and visit him. Like, I don't know anyone at the age of 20 felt at the age of 25 who would do something like that today.
That's not good. I hope that's not true about our younger generation. I know my sons, our youngest son, is 25, I know he's 26 now. The years go by so fast, but he sure will. So he's got that.
So Jack, I have been told by my friend and mentor Joel Nagel that I need to ask you about your time with Reagan.
Oh boy. 1965, I was a graduating senior at UCLA. And Reagan came to give a speech. And there was all this buzz that he was going to run for governor. And he gave the speech, and everybody, whether they disagreed or not, completely respectful, you know, very respectful. And unlike today, of course. At any rate, what he said was, you know, this political spectrum of left and right, I don't understand. Communism on the left, fascism on the right, I don't get it. Fascism, Nazism, communism, I don't get it. My political spectrum is up and down. Up towards individual freedom, down towards control of the individual by the state. So in my political spectrum, all forms of totalitarianism, whether they are fascism or Nazism or communism, Marxism, all of them belong at the bottom of the spectrum. Control of the individual by the state. And I am an advocate of individual freedom on the upside, but I'm certainly no anarchist, no government at all. We have to have a government. I believe in a government with the rule of law and a constitution that gives, that protects the individual, the rights of the individual. And that's where I am on this. And I turned to a friend of mine and I said, that settles that. And he said, settles what? And I said, that's my guy. I've always wanted to hear that sound. Always. See, when I was, you know, the episode of the Soviet Union, I mean, what I never understood. It was a puzzle to me. And I've got it figured out to some degree now, but you know, I knew that I never saw a difference between Nazism and communism. Never. I mean, they're both forms of fascist control over individual, crushing of individual freedom. I mean, why would they think they're any different? Now, I can explain the difference, by the way, and maybe we'll get in that later. But at any rate, I came home that weekend, and my father, he's a producer, and he was a well-known person in Hollywood. I asked him if he knew Ronald Reagan. He said, well, yeah. I mean, he was an actor back then. I mean, he was not Ronald Reagan, you know, Ronaldus Magnus, you know. So I said, well, Dad, he gave this speech, and I just can't get over it, and I wonder if I could meet him. Now, I don't know what I was saying. I just, you know how, what happens is you just find the words coming out of your mouth, and you wonder where the hell that came from, you know. But I found myself saying it. And he saw that something, see, we had met so many people. I mean, Bob Hope and Frank Sinatra, and you name it. I mean, John Way, I mean, all kinds of people. And it was great. It was cool to meet these people, but I never asked to meet anybody. And that was the first one. And so he called him up. And he said, hey, Ron, this is Jackson. Jackson Wheeler is my father. And it's my son. Hey, Jackson, how are you? Well, my son heard your speech at UCLA, and he's really taken by it. And he wanted to meet you. Well, come on over. So he's, okay, he got in the car and drove over to the Pacific Palisades. And there he was. Nancy wasn't there. And it was just him and an assistant or something. And I remember saying, you know, him explaining. What he said, I can't remember, to tell you the truth. What I remember is he put his hands up when he was done. He was sitting in an easy chair, and he put his hands up, and he said, and that's the way I feel. And I said, Mr. Reagan, you know, I have to tell you, this is exactly how I feel. And I know that you're running for governor, or if you decide to run for governor, if there's anything I can do, I would do it to help you. Well, here's a kid, college, you know, telling the man who wants to run for governor. And I didn't know what I was doing, by the way, because as soon as I graduate, I got to get back to, believe it or not, Vietnam, where I had a business, an export business, and I had no business at all, you know, saying something like this. But my father ended up going to Vietnam running the business while I was working for Ronald Reagan. He offered me to be state chairman of Youth for Reagan. And we had this amazing time, the original Ronald Reagan for governor campaign in spring of 1966, was an extraordinary time. And then I had to get back to Vietnam, but there were all these kids. But I got to spend that whole spring. We drove around because Reagan hated to fly. He'd never fly in an airplane without four engines. And so a lot of the stuff was driving. And I drove all over the place with him. There's nobody like Ronald Reagan. I met a lot of famous people, a lot of famous celebrities, and I've never met anybody like Ronald Reagan. A depth, there was this gravitas that he had that nobody else had. Is a magic person. But at any rate, there were all these kids in Youth for Reagan. We became just buddies. Many of us are still buddies to this day. But, okay, I'm not in politics. I help Ronald Reagan, and so now I got a business to run, and I got a PhD to get, and, you know, et cetera. And so I never want to be in politics. But a lot of those other kids, they stuck around. And by 1980, 15 years later, 1981, Ronald Reagan is president of the United States, and they are in the White House. And all of a sudden, that old fantasy of mine came about. about, you know, organizing or helping to organize rebellions against the Soviet Union. And so I told one of my friends, I said, you know that map I have? I'm looking at the map right now, as a matter of fact. The map I have in my study with all those lines on it where I've been in the world? He said, yeah. I said, the map really looks different to me. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, well, Dana's, the guy's name is Dana Romer. Dana, you know, we know what's going on in Afghanistan. That's just blown up. Soviets are starting to have a difficulty there. Something going on in Nicaragua. But there's also something going on in Angola and Mozambique. I keep hearing these things. And I'm doing a lot of research on it. And all of a sudden, it's dawning on me, Dana, that there is a worldwide rebellion against the Soviet Union emerging. And he said, what? And I said, I'm telling you, man, I smell it. I know the world fairly well. Of course, this was a long time ago. It was 1983. And he said, well, nobody here, meaning the White House, said anything like this. I never heard anything like that. What are you going to do about it? I said, you know, Dana, I'll be right back. So I raised some money. I formed this little foundation. I raised some money. And I was gone for 6 months. And I talked my way into all of these guerrilla wars. And I came back to the White House with all these pictures. And there was a big meeting. It was November of 83. And there were West Wingers and agency people and all kinds of people. And National Security Council. And I showed them all these pictures. And they'd never seen the pictures. They just read stuff, you know? They just read stuff. But it's just ink on paper, the pictures. I told them stories about the people, you know? What happened? This is a young boy named Amin. He picked up what looked like a toy in Afghanistan, blew his hands off. It's a Soviet butterfly bomb made to maim kids like this. This is what they're doing. And I said, there really is a rebellion emerging, not everywhere, but in a number of Soviet colonies, because the Soviet colonial empire has a structure to it. And if we support the entire phenomenon of resistance to Soviet colonialism, why, we can assault the structure of the Soviet colonial empire. Not just have one thing for Afghanistan and one thing for Nicaragua, and wouldn't be great if they got a new government. Great. But we want the Soviet colonial empire gone. Like the English colonial empire, the Dutch colonial empire. They're gone. We want it gone. And this is the way to do it. And that was the birth of what the press called the Reagan Doctrine. And so that's what I did in the 80s. I just went out to all these groups and came back and told the White House and briefed everybody on. And that's how the Reagan Doctrine got started. And then it moved into Eastern Europe, just as I had predicted. But then it wasn't, you know, Stinger missiles, you know, to the Afghans. It was fax machines and stuff like that. Because Solidarity had gotten going and all the other groups.
Well, from my understanding, you actually helped connect a lot of these different groups together. And what was it? Had a conference or had a meeting so that different resistant leaders could know and understand each other so they were not alone?
Yes, we had it in, it was called the Jamba Conference. And that was, I'm pretty sure it was 86, you know, right around there. But we did. We brought people from the Contras and the Afghans and Angola and people from Europe, etc., resistance movements. And Jamba was the center of guerrilla-occupied territory in Angola. In southeastern Angola. That was really something. It got a lot of coverage. But that was how it all got started.
That's incredible. That is just such a moment in history for all of humankind. That's unbelievable, Jack.
Yeah, I remember I remember giving a speech at the Heritage Foundation. It was in May of 1989. And I'd been giving this talk, variants of it, since 84, all over the United States, business groups, colleges who freak out, of the coming collapse of the Soviet Union, or the coming collapse of the Soviet Empire, two different variations. And people didn't believe it. I mean, like, what? Well, it'd be great, but never in my lifetime. It was just impossible to believe. And I said, well, here's how it's going to happen. And so in May of 89, I gave this talk. And this is the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. This is the conservative headquarters, right? And I told them that the Berlin Wall would be down in a couple of years. And they laughed. They all laughed. And I smiled and I said, you know, folks, it doesn't bother me that you laugh at all. Doesn't bother me at all. I just have one request, that you remember that I said this on this day. You remember this, that I said it, because it's going to be in 2 years or less. Well, it's down 6 months. November 9th, 1989, World Freedom Day, Berlin Wall. So it was this, I told him about the myth of invincibility, that there was this myth that the Soviet Union is so mighty and so powerful, there's nothing that could be done. And Ronald Reagan didn't believe that. He sure did. And I just took that and run with Brandon.
Well, this has been fascinating, Jack, because we kind of started the conversation speaking about your personal philosophy and how that developed, and then really how that led you to liberty and freedom and capitalism. So talk to me a little bit about the things that you want to do going forwards, the things that you're passionate about, the things that you're passionate about today, the things that you want to accomplish next, because I would say, I would guess that you're not done.
I hope not. Yeah. Well, first, the world is a very, very big place. And there is this thing about, oh, the world's getting smaller. No. The world should always be getting bigger. Always be getting bigger for you. There's more to know, more to learn, more to experience. Just take any country. You name any country on the map, and it's really looks small on the map. Okay, and you get there, and all of a sudden you realize, oh my gosh, there's so much more I didn't know about. And it expands in your mind. Before it was this little blip on the map, and now it's this huge place in your mind. The world should always be getting bigger, and you'd never run out of things. You could live 1,000 years, and you never learn and experience at all, not even close. So there's a lot of that. There's always things that I'm thinking of, you know, cool stuff to do in the world that would ring people's bells. They'd like to have that experience with me. Whether it's the Australian outback or climbing the Karstens Pyramid in New Guinea, or scuba diving in the greatest scuba diving areas in the world, or go exploring Kamchatka and Siberia, and it just goes on and on and on. It's endless. So that's what we do at Wheeler Expeditions. People are free to log on to our website, WheelerExpeditions.com, all one word, WheelerExpeditions.com, and check us out. And if they'd like to go on an adventure with us, a real adventure, a real experience, why, we do all different kinds. They don't have to be rough and ready. Some are just plain fun. So we're going to three magic Atlantic paradises in the Atlantic Ocean that the people may not be familiar with, and that's just plain fun. The other thing, though, is that I've got two books to write. I'm writing one book. The working title is Overcoming the Evil Eye. If there's one thing that I would like people to understand about what makes the world tick, at least politically, it's this: the greatest, one of the most dominating social forces, malevolent social, the most malevolent social force in the world is envy. Most of the, well, all three of the great curses of modern times, when I say curses, in the last 70, 80, 90 years, are religions of envy. Communism is class-based envy. The rich exploitative bourgeois, the rich exploitative rich, like Alexandria Cortez or whatever her name is, says. Nazism is the same thing. But instead of a class-based envy, it's a race-based envy. Those rich exploitative Jews. And if you just substitute Jews and bourgeois, you get an equivalence. They demonize Jews because they're in a race. The communists demonize capitalists because they're into the class thing and the whole exploitation thing. Like, you can't get rich without making somebody else poor. It's like saying you can't be healthy unless you make somebody else sick.
Yeah, people don't understand it's not a zero-sum game.
Try that on. I mean, how stupid would that be? But that's the essence of Marxism. That wealth is, they don't understand wealth is created, and we get it. But at any rate, the same thing with Islamic terrorism, Islamic radicalism. It's all an envy trip. The rich, exploitative West. They can't stand it. They're envious. But that's really not the problem, because, the Bible tells us not to envy. And it does no good. The 10th commandment, thou shalt not envy, thou shalt not covet. Okay? That's the 10th commandment, and it's never been obeyed, and there's nobody ever does anything about it. Just say, don't envy, you shouldn't envy. The real thing is what I call the fear of being envied, and that is a hard grasp to hold on to. The fear of being envied, and I'll give you an example. There is a tribe in the Amazon on the border between Venezuela and Brazil. They're called the Yanomamo. And the Yanomamo, when a Yanomamo woman gives birth to a baby, she will call out in this loud lament, making sure everybody in the village hears her, "Oh, my baby is so ugly. Why have the gods cursed me with this ugly baby? Oh, so ugly." Wail, 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 cry. And that is so. Her villagers will not envy her happiness over her beautiful little child. People hold themselves down. They apologize for themselves. People apologize for their existence. They apologize for being what? Anything now, but particularly American, because they feel the envy directed towards America. And so they're always apologizing for America. They're always putting America down. They're always criticizing it because they're afraid of the envy of others. And so I am writing about this and the solution of how to overcome it, because envy has no control over it. It's like voodoo. if you don't know that voodoo, you don't care. Somebody's making a dollar and sticking needles in it. Thank you for sharing. I would, you know, go play in the traffic. That has no effect, right? It has no effect. They're impotent. And so to impotize, if that's a correct term, make impotent, the whole envy trip, whether it be Islamic or fascist or communist or Nazi or whatever, is not be afraid of the envy. That's what I'm writing about. It's overcoming the evil eye. Because the evil eye is the evil eye of envy. Black magic. All black magic is envious magic. It's based on envy. So, and all socialism is based on that. So at any rate, I've got to write that. I'm writing that book now. That's the next book.
That sounds fantastic. I am definitely picking that up because I would love to hear more of your thoughts on that. Jack, today's conversation has been absolutely fascinating. If my listeners want to learn more about what you do, if they want to get a hold of you, where can we send them?
WheelerExpeditions.com.
Fantastic. And I'll make sure I put the links to everything we talked about in at the show notes at expatmoneyshow.com. Jack, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, great. Mikhail, this has been fun. I really appreciate your inviting me on your show. I think we've had a great time. I want to thank you very much.
My pleasure. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Jack.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Mikhail here. So I have an ask for you today. If you're enjoying this podcast, what I want you to do is go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. If you want to leave us a 5-star review, even better. If not, tell us why. We are really doing our best to make this show the absolute best it can be to help as many people to go offshore and inspire entrepreneurs and investors and business owners to move their businesses abroad. There's so much to be had in this industry. I love doing this work and I love doing this podcast. But we want to get the message out there to more people. And the best way to do that is with reviews. So if you have ever gotten one good tip, one good thing from this show, if you enjoy listening to us every single Wednesday or whenever you listen during the week, then please take 30 seconds out of your day, go out there, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It actually makes a big difference for the show, for the visibility, and really helps get the word out there. So I appreciate that. Thank you so much, everyone, for your support.
This episode may be over, but your journey to greatness continues by visiting our webpage and signing up for our newsletter. For convenient access to new episodes, show notes, and other crucial resources, visit expatmoneyshow.com. We look forward to you joining us on the next episode of the Expat Money Show. Safe travels.
Decentralized finance and digital assets are moving at lightning speeds. What we know for sure is that this innovative asset class is here to stay. The best companies in the world are investing millions of dollars into research and development. But of the 12,000 plus projects listed, how do you know what to buy? Looking at the on-chain and off-chain data requires a deep background and understanding of technology applications, finance, and experience in the art of speculation. And add to that the insider information necessary takes relationships you likely don't have. Remember, if you get your research for free, you are the product. The simple fact is quality research takes money. That's why paying for top quality analysis is the smart move. If you're interested in maximizing your returns in the crypto space, you need to sign up for SerenityNewsletter.com. At SerenityNewsletter.com, we publish cutting-edge reports on upcoming projects. In 2021, we correctly predicted the first, second, fifth, and eighth biggest winners, with returns as high as 26,000%. That is enough to change anyone's life forever. To subscribe today to the best crypto analysis available, go to SerenityNewsletter.com. That's SerenityNewsletter.com.